I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty. We're the Armstrong and Getty Show.
We cover the stories the mainstream media ignores.
Stories that are important to your life and important to the world.
The election, of course.
The many trials of Donald Trump.
Couple of wars.
Gender-bending madness.
Why are kids looking at so much social media?
And we bring you the stories the mainstream media is on.
But we do it without the left-wing media spin.
Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Open your free iHeart app and search the Armstrong and Getty Show to start listening.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. This week, I talked to Orlando Bloom in a rare interview where we went deep into how to get comfortable with fear and how to change the guilt and shame thought pattern.
People say, what are you afraid of, right? I'm afraid of fear because it's like I want to confront anything in my life that feels challenging on those levels.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Buck Sexton Show podcast. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the Russian invasion of Ukraine grinds into its fourth week, the scope of the humanitarian tragedy that's unfolding is becoming more clear. In addition to the climbing death toll, millions of Ukrainians have been displaced and cities around the nation have been reduced to rubble. We'll take a look at the latest in this war in tonight's Hold the Line. Welcome to Hold the Line. I'm Buck Sexton. The war in Ukraine continues on. The U.S. looking for some means of pushing Putin toward an off-ramp here, getting together with our allies, trying to find ways to pressure the Russian war machine to at least come to a ceasefire, if not a total halt in Ukraine. That would be progress, to be sure. The first thing they're offering up now is, on the diplomatic front, Joe Biden himself, the White House saying that he is visiting Poland on a trip this week. And we'll obviously be talking a lot about the humanitarian aspect of the mission there, as well as how to try to bring the situation to a conclusion in Ukraine as quickly as possible. It seems that the discussion around a no-fly zone has become markedly less loud. There are far fewer people in the U.S., at least, that have been calling for that in recent days, probably because they know more about it and understand that a war with Russia for the U.S. would be disastrous and perhaps even for the whole world, as the specter of nuclear weapons always is in the background of any possible military conflict between the United States, NATO, and Russia. So what can we do here? On the one hand, the pressure campaign economically, politically, and otherwise is growing against Vladimir Putin, and now there are even calls for bringing a war crimes prosecution at some point in the future against Vladimir Putin personally. Here is the Secretary of State of the Biden regime, Blinken, saying just that.
We're also looking very carefully at what is happening, what is being done, and in particular looking at the question of whether war crimes are being committed. And among other things, the intentional targeting of civilians would constitute a war crime. We are documenting. We welcome the efforts of various groups, institutions, organizations that focus on this to bring all of the evidence together, to continue to document things, and then for there to be accountability one way or the other. In terms of other designations based on actions that Russia is taking, we are and we will look at everything.
accountability for war crimes. Does anybody really believe that Vladimir Putin will be held to account? Does anyone think he'll be dragged into any court, the International Criminal Court or anywhere else, to answer for war crimes? He's the president of the Russian Federation. They have thousands of nuclear weapons. They have the third most powerful military in the world. It is unserious for someone to think that Vladimir Putin is really going to face a criminal trial based on his war crimes. But these are the things that we in the West, I suppose, are going to hear from our leadership when they don't want to seem as though there's nothing that they are willing to do or can do in the face of Russia's aggression. That aggression is also causing, as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, an enormous humanitarian catastrophe. UN spokesman has said that more than 10 million people have been displaced in Ukraine, about 6.5 million internally, 3.5 million have become refugees, have fled the country that is their homeland. Watch.
Since February 24th, more than 10 million people have now been forced from their homes in search of safety and security, nearly a quarter of the population of Ukraine. This includes an estimated 6.5 million men, women, and children who are internally displaced, and that's according to our friends at the International Organization for Migration, and nearly 3.5 million people, mostly women and children, who have crossed international borders out of Ukraine as refugees.
Look, this is a terrible circumstance. Vladimir Putin's Russia is the aggressor, and this never should have happened. The world, in a diplomatic sense, has failed in preventing this conflict. Yes, the primary onus is on the Russian Federation, Vladimir Putin personally, for launching the war in the first place. We all want this thing to end as quickly, as soon as possible, with the absolute minimum loss of life. Far too many lives have already been lost. As part of that, we need to be very realistic about what does an end to this conflict really look like. Are we hoping that the Ukrainians will turn the tables militarily and defeat the Russians? Seems almost impossible for that to be the case. So what we would have to get to is a negotiated settlement. That would mean that the leadership of Ukraine and Russia agree, whether meeting in person or through intermediaries, to have some state of affairs where Russia is likely to get an agreement about neutrality and non-joining of NATO from Ukraine, and also some territorial concessions. That is likely to be the price to have the Russian war machine stop its onslaught against the Ukrainian people. We also have to be realistic about how long the sanctions will stay in place against Russia, because we in the West, particularly in America, have been led to believe by the press that the sanctions are crippling, going to just destroy the Russian economy. Is that going to change Putin's calculation? And how long are those sanctions likely to stay in place? How long will the world stay united in limiting Russian fossil fuel exports and not buying from Russia what would be on the open market or the energy markets? The answer is not very long at all. In fact, as part of the ceasefire agreement that we hope to get soon, or that hopefully will happen soon, the Russians will likely say that they will also want some economic normalcy to be restored as a function of their stopping this aggressive war. These are all going to be very unpalatable things to the international community. People are going to say, oh my gosh, we're going to still be doing business with Putin in the future. We're not going to see him dragged into the Hague, or he's not going to face war crime tribunals. He's not going to be ousted from power. He may just manage to get some of or most of what he wants in Ukraine, and then we're all told to move on. Yeah, that's probably what's going to happen. And it's best if everybody understand that likelihood now, so there isn't some sense of emotional impulse to scuttle a possible deal just because, oh my gosh, what do you mean that that's going to be the future? And the Biden administration knows this at some level. They're just not telling it to you that openly. This is why they're trying to broker a nuclear deal with Iran, and they want Russia's buy-in for the nuclear deal with Iran, so they're going to create a carve-out for Russia in that nuclear deal. And when Psaki's asked about it, watch what she says.
The president called Putin a war criminal yesterday. The Secretary of State just said that that was also his view today. So given all of that, why are we still having Putin's Russia broker the Iran nuclear deal talks?
Well, I would say that it's not in our interest for Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon, and Russia is a member of the P5 plus one. So that is pursuit of a deal that would be in our national security interests.
So yeah, we're still going to do diplomatic stuff with Russia, still going to work with Russia on things.
Exactly. But right now it's all, anything to stop you, anything to stop the war in Ukraine, they tell you. But not if it means that it messes up their Iran nuclear deal, slash if it means that the price of oil stays too high going into a midterm election, slash fill in the blank. Yeah, it's fun to pretend that people have such conviction in this country about what's going to be done there. And then we look at the price tags. We'll have more on the situation in Ukraine with senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Bill Roggio, in a moment. Let's talk about protecting your online data for a moment. A lot of companies promise your privacy is guaranteed. It's just not true. That's why you need a new cybersecurity company called Secure. It's spelled S-E-K-U-R. Secure uses proprietary encryption and is offering secure instant messaging and email. With Secure, all of your communications based on servers and data centers hosted in Switzerland without using any of the big tech platforms. Privacy is a big issue now. Without real security, people can read your emails, messages, even your bank information. Secure is your solution to stop the constant theft of your digital identity. It costs only $5 for the messenger, only $10 for the messenger and email combination package. Go to secure.com and take back your privacy today. That's S-E-K-U-R.com and use promo code BUCK for 25% off. We'll be right back with more Hold the Line. There's a battle going on right now that may be the most important fight our country's had since the Revolutionary War. Once again, it's about our freedom. People like you and me are being canceled, our speech increasingly censored by big tech and corporate media. Can't let that happen. Time to fight back. Please stand with us and support The First TV. Be a part of our team dedicated to preserving the very essence of who we are, free Americans. It's day 26 of the war in Ukraine, and the country's defiance is on full display. Ukrainian officials rejected yet another Russian demand to surrender in the city of Mariupol. As the brutal invasion grinds into its fourth week, a physical war wages in the cities and countryside, while an information war is taking place over the internet and the airwaves. Although Ukraine has certainly won the war on social media and in the press in the West, our next guest says this gives the average Western viewer the impression of a lopsided victory in favor of Ukraine. So what's actually happening on the battlefield? Let's talk to our friend Bill Roggio at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Bill, good to see you.
Thanks, Buck. Always a pleasure.
So just bringing you in to tell us, man, what is the battlefield update right now? Where does this stand? Who's moving where? And on balance, who has the military momentum?
Yeah, we keep hearing that the Russian offensive has stalled. That's a word that we've actually heard since day one or day two of this. The Russians still have the initiative. They're just moving slowly at this point. I wouldn't call it stalled because, like, look, I'm reading articles where the Russians are stalled, except in the east and except in the south. Well, that isn't stalled. Outside of Kiev, that's absolutely true. The Russians have definitely not taken more ground. That is a problematic area for them. But then again, we don't know if they're just laying the groundwork for a siege. The problem is everyone thinks they understand in depth what's going on in the minds in the Kremlin and in Russia's defense ministry. We don't know exactly what their plan is and what they're thinking. I take a look at the operations as they're unfolding on the ground and see what's happening and try to deduce from that. But I don't know what Putin is thinking, and I don't know what his generals are thinking, but I can see what they're doing. And they're continuing to slowly push to encircle Ukrainian troops in the east and advance northward from the south as well as westward towards Odessa. One of the things they told us from day one is the Russians don't want to fight. They're taking massive casualties. They're losing all their vehicles. They're deserting. And yet they're still continuing to advance. Both can't be true.
Well, we have Biden's UN ambassador. Control room, we have this clip. Biden's UN ambassador, Linda Thomas Greenfield, can't say if Biden will recognize Crimea and other parts of Ukraine. Can you play that clip for me, guys?
Would the U.S. Recognize Crimea, recognize these independent breakaway republics if Zelensky were to cede those areas in peace negotiations with Russia?
I can't say that at the moment. We certainly have not recognized the independent Donbas regions that the Russians just declared as independent. But I can't preview how we will respond to a negotiated settlement that the Ukrainians come up with the Russians to save the lives of their own people.
I mean, I think I feel like we can preview it at some level here, Bill, because unless I'm missing something, it's a total non-starter that Crimea and the Donbas are going to be in, under anything other than Russian control at the end of this. So really, then it seems like it turns into what formal concessions are is the Ukrainian government and Western allies, including us, willing to make here to get the carnage, the fighting to stop? I mean, is that how you see this playing out? Where is it going?
Yeah, that's exactly how I see it playing out. The fact is those the areas, a lot of the areas that the Russians take, particularly along the coast of the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov, I suspect the Russians are going to want to keep them. They expended an enormous amount of blood and treasure for this invasion. Those are strategic areas for the Russians. And not only are they does the Russian want to expand its territory and create a buffer, but it's going to want to neuter the Ukrainian government as much as possible. And to do that, taking particularly the Black Sea ports, that will seriously impede the Ukrainians' ability to export things like its agriculture and other items that, you know, other exports that go through the ports into the Black Sea and out to the world. So, you know, I think it's kind of odd that the administration say, you know, to me, what I heard there was that they're seriously contemplating that as at least the beginning of the negotiations, the recognition. And how would the U.S. not recognize these if the Ukrainians were willing to cede it?
Yeah, and I want to, I mean, I'm curious at this point, do you think what would be a bare minimum acceptable deal? I know that you said, and I appreciate the honesty here, because so many people walk around, they act like on TV and in their editorials, they're sitting down having conversations with Putin every day. I feel like Putin has defied the expert consent, first of all, in launching the war in the first place, and then at various points since and before, the experts on him tend to be wrong. But what do we think is a bare minimum acceptable framework for Putin to stop the war that he has launched, which is what could get us to a ceasefire? What would he have to have?
He would have to, I think, again, he would keep those areas along the back Black Sea that he controls, obviously the Donbas and Crimea. And I think he would want assurances. He'd want a neutral government in Ukraine, one that would guarantee that it would not join NATO. And he may also ask for a demilitarized Ukraine as well. I think those things are all on the table. And I think the Russians are still fighting here because they still want to take large sections of eastern, particularly of eastern Ukraine. And I don't think you're going to see any type of real negotiations play out until that operation either fails or the Russians are successful. What I'm seeing right now is the Russians are close, maybe weeks from completing the encirclement of the far eastern part of the Ukraine.
By the way, there's some reporting about how there are some, you know, the Ukrainians are obviously outgunned and there's far more military personnel on the Russian side too. But there's this elite unit deploying small stealth drones to drop anti-tank grenades on Russian targets. Apparently these are very effective. And there's also these switchblade kamikaze drones. Are these what exactly? How well are these working?
Well, they're not in theater right now and they haven't been used on the battlefield in a massive scale. As far as the switchblade drones, I've heard that about 100 are going to be sent, or more than 100 will be sent to Ukrainians. They're going to have to be trained on how to use them, and then they're going to have to employ them on the battlefield. Well, 100 is not all that much. I mean, you combine that with the other anti-tank missiles, javelins, and others that are coming in the area. I think this equipment that's coming in is enough to hurt the Russians. The question, and I can't answer, is it enough to blunt the Russian offensive? Is it enough to stop them in their tracks in Kiev and in the east and for operations in the south? We won't know. My personal opinion is it's certainly a worthy effort. And the more we could punish the Russians to and make them reconsider invading another country, driving the costs up so high that they really have to reconsider invading Moldova or another non-NATO country, that is certainly a worthy effort. We're going to see this play out over the course of weeks and months, I believe. I think this fighting is going to continue.
Bill, appreciate the perspective as always. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me, Buck. Always a pleasure.
With Hunter Biden's laptop now admitted to be authentic by the New York Times, we've known that for a long time, many are now turning their focus to members of the media and the intelligence community who tried to cover up the bombshell story and did so with some success. Will there actually be any accountability, though? The First TV's Tiana Lowe joins us to discuss when we come back. Right now, let me tell you why you need to protect your home. Hackers capitalize on uncertainty and things going around you with lots of craziness, right? Chaos out there. Well, there's a lot of scams you can expect, but there's a bigger scam that's hard to detect and even harder to stop. It could cost you your home. It's called home title fraud. Happens when the hacker finds the title to your home online, because that's where all home titles are. Then he forges your signature and removes you from your home's title, takes out loans on your home, leaves you in debt. What makes home title fraud so devastating is you usually won't know until it's too late. So, look, you could try to just wait and see if this happens to you, or you could be proactive. Go to HomeTitleLock.com. Enter your address to see if you're already a victim of this crime and don't even know it. Smart to do this. Go to HomeTitleLock.com. Again, that's HomeTitleLock.com. Tiana Lowe stops by in a moment. It took more than a year, but last week, the left-wing media finally admitted that the laptop from hell, Hunter Biden's laptop, very real. Surely the people who ignored the story, or really just suppressed it and lied about it, will be held accountable professionally in some way, right? Wouldn't hold your breath. This weekend, the New York Post, who originally broke the story, ran this cover calling out the 51 so-called intelligence experts who falsely claimed that the laptop was likely part of a Russian disinformation campaign. The group included former DNI chief James Clapper, CIA director John Brennan, and Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, among others. To date, not a single one of them has apologized or even acknowledged the error. They wonder why nobody trusts American intelligence services, something I know a bit about, unfortunately. Joining us now to discuss is the First TV's Tiana Lowe. Tiana, good to see you.
Hey, Buck.
So, this is pretty clear, right? Pretty straightforward. New York Times, and it should be said, didn't come out with a big mea culpa. I think it was in paragraph 26 of a very long story of the federal tax investigation into Hunter Biden was like, yeah, this laptop, it turns out in the filings, you know, it's real. Gee, I guess that's journalism, kind of.
Yeah, and this is one where clearly, you know, Hunter Biden being a crackhead running around Ukraine, taking bags full of cash from anyone who would give him money for his last name, that's a corruption story as old as politics itself. Kind of boring, actually. The cover-up is absolutely worse than the crime because think of the implications. We expect stupid second trust fund baby sons to act stupidly. What we don't expect, at least so shamelessly and so out in the open, is for the supposed arbiters of truth, and half of them, you know, national security analysts, people who used to have access to, you know, consulting presidents about whether or not they should use nukes, for them to so flagrantly and so openly lie to fit their political agenda. Look, Hunter Biden is still doing his open air money laundering thing. I don't think anyone believes that, you know, anyone wants to pay seven figures for his supposed artwork, which is what's going on right now. They are private auctions where we don't get to know anything about who the purchasers of these arts are. You know, it could be Russian oligarchs. It could be, you know, members of the Iranian elite. But the thing that's still happening that's much more scary is we're seeing these spooks, you know, the same people who got 20 years of forever war in the Middle East wrong, and then just were convinced that they were even more right. Now, as they take us on the cusp of the war to Russia, we're just seeing how openly partisan they are. Not that we didn't know, but this is just such glaring evidence that I think it transcends what the talking heads think normal Americans care about. They don't want to be told that the sky is green. They know a lie this big when they see one.
Meanwhile, speaking of lies, it's not just Hunter Biden who's told a lot of them. The actual president of the United States has repeatedly, aggressively, and without any sense of being repentant for it, lied about Hunter Biden's laptop. Watch this one.
We have 4 days left, and all of a sudden, there's a laptop. There's overwhelming evidence that from the intelligence community that the Russians are engaged.
I still think that the stories from the fall about your son, Hunter, were Russian disinformation and a smear campaign, like you said.
Yes.
The vast majority of the intelligence people have come out and said there's no basis at all.
I mean, isn't it amazing that the way that they launder the lie, they bring out a bunch of former Democrats supporting Hillary and Obama and Biden voting intel professionals so that then Biden can say, yeah, all the intel professionals, as if they don't have political beliefs, supported me based on nothing. And that means we're all supposed to be quiet about this now? That doesn't seem to make sense.
I mean, honestly, it should scare us all that these were the people responsible for, you know, shredding the Constitution to smithereens under the guise of national security. Because, I mean, that's what a lot of the early aughts were. That's what Clapper and Brennan and the rest of these hacks were all doing. They were entrusting us to give up our you know, liberties for a little bit of security, which, as a reminder, you know, Ben Franklin reminded us we cannot do if we wish to keep a functional republic. And so with Biden, you know, it wasn't even just the lie. It's one thing just to deny, whatever, call the New York Post a tabloid, even though it was founded by Alexander Hamilton. Claim, you know, it was just Rudy Giuliani making stuff up, even though he's been completely vindicated. Calling it Russian disinformation, you know, it is kind of surprising when you look at the public opinion polling. You know, I hope that a lot of the people who don't want a no-fly zone, it's not because they assume that Russia is our ally, because they're not. I assume that it is. I'm hoping that it's out of fear, you know, of triggering World War III. But how many people have now just heard Russia, 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 and it is sort of like a boy who cried wolf type situation? You know, we have to redesign all of our federal election laws because Russians hacked the election. Donald Trump was an illegitimate president because Russians hacked the elections. And now, oh, you know, Joe Biden's son was, you know, a choir boy because Russia dropped disinformation. People know all of this is bunk. And so now that we're seeing us, you know, actually amp up a conflict with actual Russian aggression, how many people simply won't believe it? Because they've been so desensitized to whatever the term misinformation or disinformation even means.
And so, you know, a big part of this, I think, in the days ahead is going to be people making the connection between it's not just Hunter Biden and lies and, oh, he's a mess up, he's a screw up, who cares? Everyone, you know, everyone has a family member that has problems or whatever. It's that his dad is president, and that when his dad was vice president, he was still pulling these kinds of shenanigans. And there are real questions about corruption and about influence peddling. Turns out that the emails, and Hunt, I mean, Joe Biden has denied this, emails prove that Joe Biden met with Burisma board member Vadim Pozharsky. This is from the email. Dear Hunter, thank you for inviting me to D.C. and giving an opportunity to meet your father and spend some time together. It's really an honor and pleasure. Little Hunter, it seems, was selling access to dad at a time when, in this case, Joe Biden was basically running U.S. foreign policy in Ukraine. Seems like kind of a big deal.
Yes. And, you know, it was publicly reported before the 2020 election that Amos Hochstein, who was one of Biden's top advisors for his energy policy that he did, you know, with the vice president's office, that he told Biden staffers, you know, you have to get Hunter out of Burisma. You have to get him out of Ukraine. He can't just be taking bags of cash from strangers, profiting off his father's name. So there are members of Biden's own team who recognized this. And this was not a right-wing conspiracy theory. The calls were coming from inside the House. And yet Biden didn't do a good job cleaning it up. I mean, even, you know, I don't think Hunter did his father any favors during the campaign when he was in LA or wherever at the Soho House partying with who knows who. But it, you know, Biden was already, you know, in his 70s as vice president. And now we know he's pushing 80. He's clearly lost a step. I don't think anyone likes the idea that there are surrogates for the president that the president isn't even capable of controlling. we never want to attribute to malice that which can be attributed to stupidity. But in the case of the most important office on the planet, they both have equal consequence.
You would think so. Tina, we'll stay on this one. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
According to estimates, over 3 million Ukrainians have fled their home since the Russian invasion began last month. So how are neighboring nations handling the influx of refugees? When we come back, we'll get a firsthand account of the humanitarian crisis from a volunteer who's currently helping with the relief efforts on the border between Poland and Ukraine. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has created a humanitarian crisis in a number of neighboring countries. According to estimates, at least 3 million Ukrainians have fled their homes, a number that is growing every day. The United Nations says over 2 million refugees have found their way to Poland, where a massive relief effort is currently underway. So how are the refugees being fed, clothed, and housed, and how's this whole movement to try to help going? Joining me now from Poland's border with Ukraine is a volunteer who's currently helping with relief efforts and a friend of mine, Mr. Brian Sack. Brian, good to see you.
Good to see you, Buck.
So first off, man, we've been hearing the numbers, reading the numbers, and it's staggering when you hear about millions, you know, 10 million displaced internally or externally, millions of refugees already have left Ukraine. You can't even really imagine those numbers, but you're actually out there on the scene. What is it like on the border of Ukraine and Poland right now?
It is pretty crazy. It is a lot of these people who have come here. I mean, Poland has absorbed about 2 million at this point. I was listening to the news, and they expect another to have 3 to 5 million total coming here. It really just depends on what happens with Russia. They have, you know, they're coming through the border crossings here at Medyka, which is where I'm close to. I'm in the town called Przemysl, but Medyka, oh, that's the train station that I deliver supplies to all the time. I know it well. So they're coming here. They're crossing over at the border. They get fed at the border. If they want food, they get put on buses, they get put on trains, and they get out. Currently, there's a lot of refugees building up in Krakow. At the train station there is becoming more of a refugee shelter. But it's an intense operation, and there are so many moving parts that it's really quite incredible. Like what has happened in the last couple of weeks as far as the organization that I've been working with. And there were World Central Kitchen right there in the back. I saw the flag. I wonder if I'm in the background there. They have been. I know this train station well. It's so funny. I spent so much time. You know, it is really intense. It is, you know, and there's a great number of people who have just come here and are offering their time and energy to try to make life easier on these people whose lives have been completely uprooted.
What are you seeing? Is it mostly because there was a lot of reporting about men of essentially what would be considered of fighting age not allowed to leave Ukraine? So I guess that's 18 to 65, something along those lines. Is it almost, I mean, I'm seeing in some of the video, it looks like it's mostly women and children. Are there a lot of, you know, military age males too? I mean, who's coming across?
It's mostly women and children and their pets. It's true that the age is 18 to 60. Males 18 to 60 are not allowed to leave Ukraine, is what I've been told. So the people coming over here are mothers with their kids and leaving behind and their, you know, their husbands, their sons, their fathers. And one of the more tearful places is right at the border at Medyka and where they're crossing. Where the families are saying goodbye to the male relatives as they leave, and that's probably one of the hardest things for people to see because nobody knows what's going to happen.
What's the impression you get from the Ukrainians that you speak to? I mean, you're obviously interacting with them day in and day out. Do you get the sense that they want this fight to continue for the sovereignty of Ukraine, even if the cost is very, very high, and they want their countrymen to keep fighting, or are they just, they want it to end tomorrow, negotiated settlement? I mean, what's the sentiment that you get from them about the conduct of the war so far?
I'm working with a bunch of Ukrainian drivers out of Przemysl and who are driving into Ukraine. They're going to Lviv or other areas to refugee centers. They're going to the borders. And they all seem, you know, they want to defend their home, and this is the way they can do it. You know, I was working with a driver the other night who's wife and 6-month-old son are in Maritupol, and he can't reach them. They're in the east. It's too dangerous. He can't get there. He wants to reconnect with his family, but he also wants to defend Ukraine. I don't know of nobody who wants to capitulate to Russia. I haven't stumbled into those people at all. These are people fighting for their home.
And how are the locals in Poland dealing with this, the influx? I mean, you said 2 million into Poland already, with likely millions more on the way if the fighting continues. Are the Polish people overwhelmingly supportive of the effort to take in the refugees? Do they feel like these are their, you know, Ukrainian brothers and sisters? They want to do whatever they can for them. And what's the sentiment like on the Polish side?
It's been phenomenal. I was at the train station in Przemysl, and there are piles of baby seats and strollers, and people have just come by and dropped off stuff, any kind of things that people need on their journey out of this area. They've been really helpful. You see people standing there. They're standing at the border crossing in Medyka. They're standing at the train stations holding signs saying, I can take a family of four. I can do this. I can get you here. I'm driving to Krakow tomorrow. Everybody is helping. And it's one point of light in all this darkness, is that it's brought out this goodness in people who are trying to just help. And they do see you. Sorry.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Brian. Go ahead.
I was saying, you know, they do see that, you know, the Ukraine, it's a similar everything. I mean, the reason I'm here is because the people Russia was indiscriminately killing look very familiar to my in-laws. My wife's Polish. My kids are half Polish. I have a lot of Polish relatives here. And, you know, the buildings that they're blowing up look very familiar to me, because I've spent 20 years in Poland visiting these cities that look very similar to the ones being decimated by the Russians. And that's why I'm here. The Poles feel a great connection with the Ukrainians. It's a very similar culture. A lot of the Ukrainian drivers, I speak decent Polish, and most of the Ukrainian drivers I deal with speak Polish. So they have a shared language and, you know, a shared culture. And they have a shared history of being, you know, the doormat to European war.
Particularly Russians, from what I understand, in that part of the world.
Have and been Russia, yeah.
Really,
yeah, yeah,
really
absolutely,
rough.
Yeah.
Just a curiosity, where are they going? I mean, the refugees, are they setting up massive temporary housing facilities, or are they just taking them in, absorbing them into Polish society, families that have an extra room? I've seen different reporting on this. Where are most of the refugees, once they cross over into Poland, where do they go?
I don't know. I mean, they're coming into Medyka here. And there's a Tesco, which is a big chain store. It's been converted into a refugee shelter. It has thousands of people in it. It's like a mini city. And you have people being organized based on where they plan to go, where they're trying to get to, where they're working out visas. Some people, tonight we were discussing with my colleagues that there a tremendous number of people are now in Krakow, just basically living at the train station, trying to figure out what to do with their lives, where they're going to go. And you know, the bigger problem here is that, you know, as you see, Russia's destroying everything. They're leveling cities. So if this war ended tomorrow, they have nowhere to go. And I think that's going to be something we're going to be dealing with for quite some time. But they're going everywhere. They're going, you know, and they'll, you know, and people everywhere are accommodating. I have friends in Warsaw who are hosting families and trying to assist them in any way they could. I mean, everybody's doing everything they can do.
Brian, where can people go if they want to try to help out, even if it's just financially, you know, online, or if they want to send stuff? I mean, what do the refugees need? Yeah. I mean, if they want to help, where should people go?
So the organization I've been working with is called World Central Kitchen. My wife turned me on to it. She's a cook. And when I said I need to do something, I want to help, she said, well, why don't you work with them? It was founded by a very well-known Spanish chef named Jose Andres. And he does normally humanitarian assistance after hurricanes. And he will go in and he'll see if the hurricane's coming, they know it's coming, they're going to come in, they're going to set up so that as soon as the hurricane's over, they can start feeding people whose homes have been destroyed. In this particular case, nobody knew a war was coming. We built a kitchen that can make 150,000 meals a day. We built that in a little over a week. It was an empty space, and suddenly in one day it had two bathrooms and an office. And then in 2 days it had a walk-in cooler. And now we have 16 cooking stations, 12 convection ovens. It's incredible what has happened in this span of time. And so World Central Kitchen, yeah, they do. I'm so impressed with this operation. I would definitely donate to them. I have donated to them, and I'm donating all my time and energy to them. They are WCK.org. I think donate.wck.org. You can donate to them. And trust me, they're doing great things with the money. They are pushing out food constantly. We're bringing hot chocolate to the train station to give to kids and to the Midika crossing and all the other border crossing. I mean, it's just a wonderful operation. And honestly, some of the greatest people I've ever met, I've been working with. And I'm exhausted every day, but I'm happy every day.
Ryan, good to see you. God bless. And thank you. Thank you very much for your time and your work on this.
Thank you very much, Buck.
Dr. Fauci is back with his old BS. The face of the pandemic said that if we see a surge in cases, we need to be prepared to, quote, pivot and perhaps reinstitute some restrictions. No. How about no? But we'll get into this in quick hits. A TikToker shows just how tolerant and empathetic the left is. That'll be interesting. And Dr. Fauci is back spreading COVID panic on the Sunday shows because he's not done. I told you, been telling you for a while, he's not done. We got that on quick hits. Let's get to it. Now, you may have seen that the 500-meter freestyle swim champion for women in the NCAA college swimming is a biological male who goes by the name Leah Thomas now, formerly went by Will Thomas. And Will, or rather Leah Thomas, is 6'4" and has the body of a man because Leah Thomas is a man. It's rather straightforward. I mean, they can talk about this as much as they want. They can try to use fancy new words to describe things that we've all understood for a long time to be what they are. But people have started to speak out. They see how absurd this is. And it's wrong, and they're stealing from women's achievement in this case. That's very obvious. The left doesn't care, though, because they'll sacrifice anybody and anything for power. They have no principles. But here's a liberal TikToker who says, the girls on the UPenn swim team who don't feel comfortable changing in front of Leah Thomas. Leah Thomas has male genitals that are being exposed to all these women on a daily basis now changing. Leah Thomas has man parts. Leah Thomas is a man. And so women, you know, if you have a daughter who's on the UPenn swim team, she has to watch as this guy gets undressed because he feels like he's a woman. But this TikToker says you're transphobic if you believe any of that. Watch.
Every day, it seems like Leah Thomas's fellow athletes get more and more transphobic. Now they're saying they're uncomfortable sharing a changing room with her. You know, it's one thing to say that it has something to do with her speed. Like, that's transphobic, too. But I can kind of understand it coming from a place of ignorance and not transphobia. However, this is just blatant transphobia. Nothing to do with her swimming, nothing to do with her abilities. They just don't want to be around trans people. You know, UPenn, if you really want to show your support for Leah, kick these transphobic girls off the team. They're the problem.
I guess that young woman is fine with all women being exposed to men in the changing room. Male genitals, no problem. Just, you know, why do we, I guess we should just have unisex bathrooms, changing rooms, everything, because what difference does it make? Because that's what she's advocating for. She can try to pretend that the material world we live in has no reality, but she's crazy. Then there's this, a TikTok user who said she had sinful thoughts when she found out that Clarence Thomas was in the hospital. What?
So when I got this update about Clarence Thomas being in the hospital, I had some really sinful thoughts. I mean, I know I'm not alone, right? We all were like, is karma doing its thing right now?
People are such idiots. I don't know. I guess we find the dumbest libs on TikTok and bring some of them to you just so you can see what's out there making the rounds, sometimes going viral. But the good news is we have incredibly astute, eloquent, and brilliant Democrat leadership to fall back on in this country, right? I mean, they really understand things. They really know how to communicate with the people. And if you're going to find a single example of somebody who is the absolute best at being brilliant as a politician, Kamala Harris, here you go. Listen to this one.
The governor and I, and we were all doing a tour of the library here and talking about the significance of the passage of time, right? The significance of the passage of time. So when you think about it, there is great significance to the passage of time in terms of what we need to do to lay these wires, what we need to do to create these jobs. And there is such great significance to the passage of time when we think about a day in the life of our children.
What the hell is she talking about? Like, the passage of time. I mean, let me say, it passes, and it is time, and therefore it is the passage of time. Boom. Dr. Fauci is still running around being an idiot, being the worst. He's back, everybody. Watch.
If we do see a significant surge, particularly one that might result in increased hospitalizations, we have to be prepared to pivot and perhaps reinstitute some of those restrictions.
You got to pivot and reinstitute restrictions that never worked, you little idiot. The absolute worst. That's it for tonight's Hold the Line. The No Spin News with Bill O'Reilly is next. Shields high. There's a battle going on right now that may be the most important fight our country's had since the Revolutionary War. Once again, it's about our freedom. People like you and me are being canceled, our speech increasingly censored by big tech and corporate media. Can't let that happen. Time to fight back. Please stand with us and support The First TV. Be a part of our team dedicated to preserving the very essence of who we are, free Americans.
The Tunnel to Towers Foundation has been helping America's heroes and their families since 9/11. Hero first responders and service members who serve our communities and our country. Those who die in the line of duty or are catastrophically injured. Veterans who fought for our nation's freedom only to return home, fall on tough times, and become homeless. Heroes like Buffalo, New York firefighter Jason Arno and his family. Arno was killed while protecting his community, battling a warehouse fire. He left behind his wife and a young daughter. In their darkest hour, Tunnel to Towers provided Arno's wife and daughter with a mortgage-free home. The foundation lifted a financial burden, enabling them to stay in the home where they made memories with their hero. Join Tunnel to Towers on its mission to do good. Support the families of America's greatest heroes, the families of fallen first responders like Jason Arno, plus Gold Star families with young children, catastrophically injured service members, and homeless veterans. Donate $11 a month at t2t.org. That's T, the number 2T.org.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty. We're the Armstrong and Getty Show.
We cover the stories the mainstream media ignores. The
stories that are important to your life and important to the world.
The election, of course.
The many trials of Donald Trump.
Couple of wars.
Gender-bending madness.
Why are kids looking at so much social media?
And we bring you the stories the mainstream media is on.
But we do it without the left-wing media spin.
Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Open your free iHeart app and search the Armstrong and Getty Show to start listening.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.